Anand, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to talk to you guys today.
For the listeners, on this episode, it's going to be Carl and I from the Reverie side, and then Anand, who's the founder and CEO of Paradigm and Paradex. And Anand, we've known each other for a long time, but actually, I think you're sort of one of these guys who's not super vocal on Twitter, not super public, and insiders sort of know you, but outsiders may not have heard of what you do and who you are. Maybe you, to start off with, give us your crypto journey. How'd you end up in the crypto space? And I think interestingly, you actually started with a different company from Paradex, Paradigm, and maybe you can share the journey from start to finish.
Definitely not as vocal on Twitter as I need to be. So that's something I'm really trying to change. My journey in crypto started in 2019. My background was in crypto, was a trading background primarily, trading derivatives. I mean, I've done a bunch of different roles, starting with trading, being a quant, structuring sales, research, did a bunch of things on the desk first for interest rate derivatives and commodities, all for a bank, 2012 to 2018. It was sort of there where this idea for Paradigm first came about. In 2019, we launched Paradigm with a simple mission: trade anything with anyone and settle anywhere. This idea of trade anything with anyone, settle anywhere came from my own personal experience when I was on the desk, because I was a derivatives trader, salesperson, research, did a bunch of different things. And one thing was very clear is that there was no system that was able to handle the complexity of a simple exotic transaction, but there was no platform that could handle structuring, pricing, execution, and settlement sort of all in one. And I felt that pain when I was first on the desk. And so my background before trading was computer science. And so one of the first things I obviously did when I was on the desk was to build a janky version of what is today an RFQ platform, but to build it in Excel. The goal was mainly to automate my own day, because I was spending like 3/4 of my time with the trade booking, the mark-to-market statement generation, sort of all the boring stuff, and then spending, a third of my time trading. I didn't like that ratio, so I was like, okay, how do I minimize the work that I don't like and do more of the work that I do like? And the answer was very clearly the automation. But I was in commodities, had nothing to do with crypto. And then a series of sort of serendipitous events that eventually led me to quitting my job and then deciding to build a platform. But then instead of doing it for commodities, I decided to do it for crypto, because crypto was kind of hot. And I didn't want to, let's say, fight the incumbents in TradFi. So because I'd have to go against the brokers and the banks and all of those. And here we had this brand new asset class that had no infrastructure in the space. And it was opportunity for me and Paradigm at that time to be a true first mover. The decision was quite easy to build Paradigm as a block trading platform, or what is today called a block trading platform. But in simple terms, Paradigm is a OTC exchange, or an over-the-counter marketplace, where institutions can buy and sell derivatives in large size. Small sizes, you can go directly to the exchange. But for the large and complex transactions, you kind of use Paradigm. Now, fast forward to today, and that business, which is our main business, we do anything between $800 to $1 billion in volume. We have a very large network of institutional traders on the platform. I think at this point, it's over 3,000, and 500 of which are active, 250 of which are very active. And on average, we are about 30 to 35% of the global, or rather the options volume on Deribit, which is the largest exchange for options out there. So that was kind of like my first jump into crypto. I sort of identified this problem where options traders were not able to trade in large sizes or trade complex transactions, and they had no platform to do it. They were sort of manually negotiating these trades in chat, in a Telegram group, and then placing those trades, or then sort of executing those trades on exchange manually. And so there was a lot of front-running risk, leg risk when you're trying to do multiple legs together. And our platform essentially solved that problem. And it also, in many ways, really birthed the institutional market, because in those days, I think Deribit was doing 20 to 50 million a day in volume. So nothing to write home about. It was very small. And then, of course, we built the solution, and we sort of told Deribit that said, hey, if you build this thing, the institutions will sort of come. Of course, it was a big gamble. It ended up being quite right. I think we had a huge part to play in actually birthing the institutional market, because most institutions, if they're trading, they trade large size, they trade complex strategies, and they want minimal impact with the order book. So they tend to trade off exchange, but then block the trade back into the exchange. So that was my first steps into crypto. I guess that's the mothership, which is Paradigm. In 2022, as you know, FTX happened. And at that time, we had a very large and fast-growing futures business on FTX. FTX was a partner just like Deribit, but we were doing a lot of the futures volume, specifically on spreads. Actually, at that time, it was about 25% of our volume. And it was an extremely fast-growing business. We went from zero to something like $300 to $500 million a day in 2 months. It was insanely fast. I've never seen grow. FTX was also a lead investor in Paradigm, and a lot of FTX clients were also institutional. So there's a big overlap in user base between both firms. So the business was very good, and there was a lot for us to sort of do. But then, of course, FTX happened, which was, you know, a Lehman-like moment for this industry. We lost close to 30, 40% of our clients. Volumes in the early months were down almost 70%. The entire industry came to terms with what counterparty risk really means. A lot of our customers were also FTX customers. A lot of eventually went bankrupt, came to us and said, you know, hey, you know, you guys are trustworthy. Why don't you start an exchange? Because we don't want to trust anybody that we sort of don't know. We want to be very careful with who we trust with our money. We obviously were affected just like everybody else. And 25% of our business is now gone. Luckily, we didn't have too much, I guess, collateral on the exchange, but it was obviously a very big dent to our business. But then we thought about what they were saying, and we said to ourselves, we said, look, this sounds like a good idea, but we don't just want to create another CeFi exchange, because I don't think you can solve or you should solve trust issues with putting in place someone that says, hey, I'm more trustworthy than the last guy. And that's kind of where blockchains come into play. And the whole point of blockchains is that they are trust machines. We knew that, okay, if we did want to do this, then it had to be a technological solution to this sort of trust problem. But of course, building a derivatives exchange on chain and putting your risk engine on chain means there's some very, very hard technical challenges and problems that you sort of have to solve. And that was really the lure for us. The opportunity was one, which is, hey, CeFi is under attack, custodial solutions are under attack. But at the same time, you know, this is also a very complex technological problem that you can solve. And that was like the real allure for us. And that's when we decided that, hey, I think we should build Paradex. We took a closer step to DeFi because in our main business, Paradigm, which is connected to the exchange, it's a centralized business in the sense that we host the order matching and then we clear on Deribit. But now we're moving to a more DeFi native, Web3 native business. And that's sort of how Paradex came about. So today, Paradex is a super performant DEX built on an L2 that is purpose-built for derivatives. That means insanely fast computations and performance and on-chain risk engine that offers a sort of a unified framework for cross and portfolio margin, and then deep liquidity, because, you know, in DEX land, liquidity is always a challenge. These are the three vectors in which we built Paradex.
That was awesome. Yeah, I remember like when we met, probably was 2018 or 2019, I was not a options or derivatives or perps trader, but you were telling me about this product you're about to build, Paradigm. At the time, I sort of thought about it as, oh, okay, like it's OTC chat app where you can negotiate and then settle to any venue of your choice. And I did do a little bit of research at the time on trying to understand what are the existing businesses that do this in the traditional financial sector. And can you kind of unpack that for the listener? You said there are companies that do offer this in TradFi, and they are pretty large businesses. Can you kind of walk the listener through what the analog product would be in the traditional world?
This is quite a niche business in the sense that it's definitely not small, but in TradFi at least, it's quite a large business. But because of the esoteric nature of these transactions, not many people tend to sort of know about it. The couple of companies that come to mind that are quite analogous to what we do in crypto, one is Tradeweb and the other is MarketAxess. In TradFi land, they're called institutional liquidity networks. So they're not exchanges, but effectively they are these off-exchange liquidity pools where institutions buy and sell either large or complex packages of contracts between themselves, and then they eventually settle using a clearinghouse or they settle on exchange. Another word for this is block trading. If you're clearing it on an exchange, then it's called a block trade where you negotiate the trade off exchange, but then you block it back into the exchange. Few different words for it, and they come in few different flavors. The easy way to think about this is think of it as a wholesale marketplace where just the large institutional traders are trading between themselves. if you ask questions like, hey, why are they doing this off exchange? There are a few reasons. The first is they want its size. So if you go on an exchange, the top of the book will probably have some amount, let's say X, but let's say I want to trade $2 billion worth of options contracts, and I want to trade them on Apple as a call spread. The fact that it's multi-leg or it has two legs, where you're buying one leg, selling the other, and the fact that the size is so large means that more than likely you're not going to be able to get execution if you went directly to the exchange, or the execution is going to be very messy. And of course, if you do execute $2 billion worth of contracts, you're going to move the price and everybody's going to know, and then that's going to result in worse execution for you. That is the reason why off-exchange liquidity networks exist. This is exactly the reason why people tend to choose liquidity networks. There's different shades of theirs. Some are what they call light and or lit, and some that are dark. A dark pool, for instance, is a good example of a liquidity network where you actually don't know anything. It's kind of this black box, and there's this order matching, some at midpoint, some at not. There's other liquidity networks which are more lit, such as an RFQ-based platform where you can effectively ping a group of counterparties. They come back with the price. You sort of know who the counterparties are, and you click and execute and you trade. Different flavors. There's lots of varieties here. But in general, the easy way to think about this is an institutional or a wholesale marketplace for institutional traders.
Yeah, and to react a little bit from the investor perspective, when I remember putting my investor hat on back in those days, I remember you mentioned those companies, TradeWeb and MarketAxess. And obviously the first thing I did, because I'd really not heard of them, is I looked them up. And TradeWeb today trades at $22 billion market capitalization, while MarketAxess is a little bit under 10. So these are pretty huge businesses. And it's kind of neat, actually, where for a lot of investors, they don't look at this kind of wonky financial tools as venture scale businesses. But I think if you actually look at the analogs in TradFi, they do get pretty large when they succeed. And of course, those markets are way larger than crypto markets. But if you expect these to grow, businesses like Paradigm will do really, really well.
Derivative marketplaces of any kind are first scalar markets. So if you do get it right, and if you are first, the dividends tend to be a lot. And it's very difficult to unseat whoever the first or second person is, because the network effects of liquidity are so strong. Very important to be first, and very important to sort of get that initial first group of users and solve a problem 100%. And that's kind of what Paradigm did for options in crypto. It's a fun fact, but you know, because of us, I think there was a lot of, let's call them manual voice brokers when we started, that were trying to sort of replicate their manual pick up the phone business model in crypto. Because of us, they don't exist anymore, because we just made the process so efficient and automated that there's no need for you to call a broker, because we can handle any amount of complexity creating a structure. You can handle any amount of size, et cetera. That's the main reason why people use Paradigm.
Now that we've covered the background, I think for a lot of our listeners, they may not be experts in derivatives trading. And it'd be really helpful to get like a really high level understanding. What is the derivatives landscape? Who are the major players? What sort of products are they offering? The most popular products, that is. And then who's the actual consumer? Who's trading these products? And let's get really high level here, and then we can dive deep down after.
The dominant force in this space for derivatives is really the perpetuals, or the perpetual futures. People have different names for them. Perpetual swaps, but that market trades something between 200 to 300 billion a day in volume, which is absolutely insanely large. And that basically is the central liquidity hub for crypto. Everything in crypto sort of comes from that. And the participants in that market, you get many different types of people. You have retail, you have pro retail, and there's many different shades of pro retail. People who are somewhat sophisticated, they write their own Python code, they deploy some strategy, to people who are just degenning and fast clicking and try to enter and exit a price and catch a trend. And then there's family offices, there's hedge funds, there's prop traders, market makers, OTC desks. This is a very, very wide variety of people. And then there's some people who do a little bit of everything. You'll see some of the larger names, let's say Wintermute or someone that has a prop trading desk. They have an OTC desk. One of the founders might have a family office through which they do a little bit of investing, a little bit of trading. So it's a nice mix, and the market has started to resemble, or I think at this point fully resembles, what the landscape, or I guess the distribution of people in TradFi markets looks like. I think at this point, you pretty much have all the types of people. Maybe not all of them have moved over, but at least all the types of people you find in crypto. And so from a size perspective, Perps trades 200 to 300 billion a day. Options, by comparison, is very smaller, trades between 3 to 5 billion a day, about 50 to 60 times smaller. And then, and by far, institutions are the largest drivers of volume in options. In retail, I think institutions obviously have a very big portion of that pie, which is 200 to 300 billion a day. But yeah, I don't actually know what the amount is, but if I were to hazard a guess, it's probably about 60-40. So 60% institutional, 40% retail.
Let's talk about perps for a second, because a lot of crypto people, they're like, oh, perps invented by BitMEX. But then some people are like, no. This product actually existed long ago and was traded, I think, in like Hong Kong exchanges in the 90s or 80s even. Can you kind of walk us through the history of the product as you see it? And then what about this product in particular makes it so popular in crypto, so much more popular than options even?
We think about this a lot. At its core, perpetuals give you leveraged exposure to the spot asset. The spot asset could be BTC, could be ETH, whatever. Effectively, what BitMEX pioneered was this idea of 100x leverage on Bitcoin, which is insane to think about at that time, because that means you could trade 100 times the notional with the same amount of capital that you have to buy, let's say, one Bitcoin. Now you can buy effectively 100 Bitcoin and speculate on the price changes and make PNL and degen your way, I guess, through this ecosystem. That was a fantastically successful product for, I think, a few reasons. One is, I mean, futures in general are not an easy product to understand. Forget even options. I think options are a step removed from that. But even futures, the fact that you have this curve of futures where you have a future for every month, let's say going out 12 months, and let's say you want to buy, you bought the Jan future or the Feb future, you have to worry about expiry once it goes off the board and it expires, and you still want direction, you know, exposure to crude oil futures, you now have to like roll into the next future. So the operational burden that comes with futures is actually quite high. And if you're a retail person that has like a full-time job that is doing other things in the day, it takes a lot of mental real estate. What Perps did, it does two things. One, it takes away this operational burden because now it's a perpetual instrument where it never expires. You never have to worry about that. But secondly, and I think equally importantly, it concentrates all the liquidity off basically the 12 futures that would otherwise have been spread out over 12 futures instruments going out 12 months or 24 months into one product. And I think the liquidity of that is just being concentrated into one single point is a superpower, because now you have this massively liquid, insanely liquid instrument that is giving you 100x exposure to the asset that you want exposure to. And all you have to do is just buy, sell, and that's it. Even funding, a lot of DJs today, they don't really understand how funding works. But for them, it's really the leverage and then the ease of getting in and out of a position that I think is so appealing. That's why perps have been so massively successful.
The success of perps being so much more successful in crypto than other markets, is it because crypto skews more retail prosumer, or it's a crypto native product that cannot be replicated as well elsewhere?
We've thought about this question a lot. We still continue to think about it. It comes up in conversations. And I think you're exactly right. Our thesis is that perps have sucked out the demand for leverage and convexity out of the market. So now what do I mean by that? Futures, in some sense, give you linear exposure to the underlying. It gives you linear exposure to Bitcoin, if you think about it in simple terms. And of course, with the leverage, it gives you linear plus leverage exposure to the underlying, which is BTC or ETH or whatever the asset is. And if you use StratFi, options gives you convexity or accelerated profits. So they're not linear profits, but if you look at it on a graph, in either direction, there's this property called convexity that gives you accelerated profits. Now, in TradFi land, options are very successful because of this exact property, which is it gives you convexity. But in crypto, most of the demand for this type of behavior has been sucked out by the perp for two reasons. Arthur Hayes, who was the founder of BitMEX, I think he had written a blog post about this, and I think it was a really great post. It was very insightful in that if you look at how a perpetual future is margined on an exchange, you can think of the initial margin like an option premium. And then above a certain number, let's say you're long, your payoff looks exactly like an option. It's capped. Basically, it's like a flat line up until you get to break even on your premium. And then boom, you have this linear exposure as it goes up. So it sort of resembles an option. And then, of course, if you go below that, then you get liquidated. So that's the equivalent of you losing your option premium if you just went long an option in, let's say, on derivative or something. So one is the structure of how a perpetual is constructed gives you an option-like payoff without actually being an option. And then because it's hyper-leveraged, so you have this combination of something that looks like an option, but also gives you super high leverage. And so when you combine that with something that looks like an option payoff-wise that is also super highly leveraged, and then you combine that with a very volatile asset class, basically all those three things together resemble the payoff of an option, which is that very sort of high gamma effect, especially for the low delta options. That is possible, especially for the shitcoins, for example. You kind of sort of get that payoff. And then, of course, in addition to that, you now have this like very concentrated liquidity instrument because all the liquidity is concentrated into one instrument. And I think that makes it super powerful. By comparison, if you do options, options on Bitcoin, for instance, the liquidity is fractured between or fragmented between multiple expiries and then multiple strikes within an expiry. So I think all those things together make the perp so, I like to say it just has sucked out all the fun or the convexity out of this market because all the degens go into the perps instead of options. And of course, on top of that, options is also harder to understand. In perps, you just entry price, exit price, and okay, I'm either paying funding or receiving funding. In options, I got to worry about expiry, strike, delta, vega, gamma, all these fancy things. I look at the screen, it's got 100 numbers on it. It's not the easiest to understand. And so I think if you combine all these things together, it makes perps a much more appealing product than options.
That was an incredible answer, actually. It's a question that we see asked a lot, and we even ask ourselves quite a lot internally, is why haven't options taken off in crypto the same way that they have in TradFi? You look at Robinhood, you look at Wall Street Bets, all those guys, all those retailers, they love trading options. And just curious, do you think there will ever be a market size for options the same way that perps have taken off? Or will perps continue to be winning this suction of liquidity, as you mentioned?
From a product builder standpoint, and of course, you know, our biggest business is in options. In some sense, I'm saying that, oh, actually, this market isn't growing as fast. And that is true. The market is growing. It's just not growing as fast as perps. Institutions still demand options. They like trading options. No surprise, most of our clients and their clients are institutional. It is growing, but it's growing by the rate of at which institutions are entering this market, which isn't that fast because, as you know, institutions just take time to do anything because they have compliance, they got this and that, all these things. The sales cycle for someone or the entry cycle sort of takes a long time. To the question of will options in their present state ever take off, I think they will continue to grow, but I think it's going to be very difficult for options to be, let's say, 50 or 60% of the futures market. Today, it's like 3 to 5 billion. I don't know. That's a very small single-digit number. But I think it's going to be very hard because of those properties that I mentioned earlier. Unless there's a few things that happen. Perpetuals, for whatever reason, let's say the volatility in this asset class starts to go down. Let's look at all those three reasons that I mentioned. One is a perpetual looks like an option in terms of its payoff. Two, it gives you very high leverage. And three, this is a very volatile asset class. Now, if this asset class and in crypto in general starts to become a low volatility asset class, which I don't imagine it happening anytime soon because, you know, shitcoins keep popping up every day. But let's say for whatever reason it does, then the attractiveness of the perpetual, basically it's a reach for yield. You will look to get towards an instrument that sort of gives you that extra boost of yield or those accelerated profits. And that comes from options. That's where options start to become super attractive. I think there needs to be a few things that happen in order for options to be attractive. Not saying it will never happen. Maybe for a few assets, you start to see BTC and ETH start to become super low volatility. Let's say like Nat Gas and they're like boring. Then now I think something like an option can give you a higher yield and therefore people invent options and then the market evolves to this new sort of paradigm. It's hard to answer. It's like a yes, no question.
That was a great explanation. On the volatility side of things, it is quite interesting in crypto. You bring up a great point that these products, especially perps, they do well in volatile periods. They don't do so well, and they just aren't as attractive anymore if the underlying asset doesn't move all that much. To your point, It's basically like buying spot. If the underlying token isn't actually moving all that much, you don't actually get the benefits of that leverage, that convexity, and all that. Where do you stand in terms of, as a product builder in this space, how do you think about volatility and how do you think about volatility in this space? Is that going to keep expanding? Do you guys view volatility as a good thing? And what is it like building around this? Something that maybe in a traditional market, you maybe wouldn't want as much. You might not actually want to build in what is a very volatile market. But for a perp market, it's a benefit. It's a good thing.
The perspective matters a lot. From our perspective, we are a marketplace builder. We get paid based on transactions or transaction volume. If you have high volatility, then that means there's going to be high volume. And so because there's high volume, our revenues are going to be higher. So in that sense, we want higher volatility. All exchanges, they really like volatility because that drives volume and profit and revenues and profit. As an investor, you might not like volatility because, you know, you might buy something and you have some view on the asset, long or short. There's crazy amounts of volatility until your view is realized. Then basically that means you're not going to sleep well at night. So from an investor perspective, volatility can be bad. But from a marketplace perspective and a product builder that is building a marketplace, we think volatility is good. Now, even a too much volatility might also be bad because ultimately it might just drive away investors and traders because, you know, it just might be totally untradeable because if something is just 500% up one day, 200% down the other day, you still might have some crazy people wanting to trade that, but most people will stay away from that. So I think the perspective matters. From our perspective, volatility at the levels they are now, it's great. Bull market volatility is back and volumes are high, and that's obviously good for all of us.
Liquidations play a pretty large part of the perp trading user experience. That's something that you don't really find anywhere else either. Your option doesn't get liquidated. It expires and you either expire in the money, out the money, whatever. If you're trading spots, you either lose money based on your cost basis. In perps, you have this element of actually being liquidated where you are forced out of your position based on your margin, based on the price movement and that sort of thing. How do you guys think about liquidations and how do you think that it is that users have been able to get so comfortable around this idea that while you're sleeping, your position might just get exited based on market activity, depending on how you've positioned yourself?
Liquidations at this point are part of the game. Everybody is gotten quite comfortable around that. Now, there's still a lot of heartburn. It's one of the things that we've done a really good job at Paradex is our risk engine and our liquidation mechanism, and which is tied to how resilient our mark price is. There's a lot of work that goes into building a very resilient mark price mechanism. To your point, users don't want to get up. And let's say the scam wicks, you've probably heard this term, is there's lots of these scam wicks where there's illiquidity or there's some crazy market event where prices rip one way or the other. And you now have this crazy wick, which is 5 or 10, 15% up. And that changes the mark price. And then the mark price is what you use to calculate liquidations. And then, of course, now the person unfairly, quote unquote, gets liquidated. I think that even though people are very comfortable with this idea because most of them have either traded on an exchange like Binance, Bybit, OKX, etc., I still think in DEX land, even in CFA, I still think there are a lot of exchanges whose liquidation mechanisms are still, they're not good. They're not bad, but they're not good. And that leads to a very bad experience for the user because from time to time, you have this idea that, oh shit, they have this feeling of being unfairly liquidated. And this is very prevalent in DEX land. And that's actually one of the reasons how we're actually one of our differentiators is our risk engine, which we built from scratch, from the ground up, has some very, very resilient mark price mechanism, which is basically robust to these scam wicks and illiquidity and all of these different things that create violent moves in the mark price. We have smoothing sort of built into that. From a user perspective, I think at this point, everybody is pretty comfortable with it. They just think it's part and parcel with trading in crypto.
We don't trade these products at Reverie, but we do invest in founders or companies that either create these products or have an exchange for these products. My one observation has been, you know, in Silicon Valley, for example, there's startup wisdom that you want to build for the customer. The product needs to fit the customer needs. And my one observation has been, it kind of does work the same way in structured products. Products like these, like the perpetual product, it really has a good understanding of what user preferences are, which is one, you want the product that's simple and gives you access to volatility exposure. And there is almost an art and a science to creating these products, marketing these products, and really catering them to the customer. And of course, the customer base, like you mentioned, it changes. If there's more institutions, maybe options will take off. And then maybe there's a particular type of product that is going to be really well suited for the institutional market. But there's so much art to this.
Might seem like all the perps everywhere are basically look the same. But when it comes down to the details, I think there's many ways in which you can build a better product than what is out there. And it very much is an exercise of what you're talking about. Who are the first group of users that we want to go after? And what are the features that we want to sort of hyper-optimize for these group of guys or girls in order to sort of like get that first core group of people? The end goal is the same. Everybody wants to be this marketplace that you can trade anything, any product, settle it instantly, and do staking products, yield products, trading products. That's the vision. Everybody wants to get there. But there's multiple paths to get there. And each path sort of comes with its own nuance and very like this tweaking, which is the balance between sort of art and science.
We've really gone deep down on the perpetuals and derivatives products. And I'm glad we did, because I think a lot of people think about this sort of stuff, but they haven't actually heard an expert talk about it. Maybe we can sort of move on at this point to Paradex. I don't know if you would describe it this way, but to me, the transition from Paradigm to Paradex goes a little bit like this. You guys already had the customers. You had all of these counterparties that are already using Paradigm. And you're settling all these products they're trading to Deribit. And then natural extension is, well, sort of could vertically integrate. You can have all these counterparties trade different products and settle on your exchange, or just trade on your exchange called Paradex. Is that how you think of the transition? And if not, how do you think about the transition from the messaging and negotiating product to the full-on exchange product?
When it comes down to it, it's actually quite simple. It actually ties back to the market sizing question you guys asked about options. One is the market for options isn't just that big. It's like 3 to 5 billion a day. We already have 30-35% of it. Even if it grows 2 times, and we can see the rate at which it's growing, it wasn't growing as fast as we would like it to be, or at least not anywhere close to where the perps market is. The TAM was a big part of this. Perps obviously is 200 billion to 300 billion. We knew that post FTX, there's going to be this migration of users from CeFi to DeFi because of these trust issues that I talked about. Custodial exchanges, you know, I think are under attack in general. And of course, not just because of this trust problem, but also from the regulators worldwide. We saw with Binance and a bunch of other exchanges, the regulators are coming after them. We know that there's going to be a group of users that A, are going to move because of trust, and then B, there's another group of users who just cannot trade on a DEX on a centralized exchange anymore because of regulatory reasons. So the answers to both those problems, I think, is to build a DEX. One was the TAM, and we knew that this opportunity is, that the time was right to kind of go after this opportunity, especially because the TAM was so big. The other part of it was our main business does options. And we, like I said, we're 30-35% of Deribit, you know, we're pretty large and dominant player there. But we wanted exposure to another asset class, but not just exposure to futures, but also diversification in terms of users, because our main business caters to mainly institutional clients. So for us, it represents a diversity of both asset and user, in addition to being a very, very large market. And we felt like the timing was right to go after it. So all those factors came together and we said, okay, now is the time to throw our hat in the ring. But of course, we just did not want to build another CeFi exchange. We don't want to solve a trust problem with trust me, bro, or like, hey, I'm more trustworthy than the last guy. And so we decided to build a DEX.
I'm super biased here, of course, but it's a very natural transition and not one that historical institutional customers would find odd. Probably really happy to have another venue where they can execute on. One thing I've really been curious to ask you about is you guys decided to build Paradex with the Starkware team and on Starknet. Can you walk us through how that decision was made? What were the top three criteria that you guys were like, this is what we need in a platform to actually build a really highly performant DEX?
It's a multi-dimensional and multi-step answer, but it really starts with what were we trying to build? We are derivatives traders and platform builders at heart. And so we said, okay, if we want to build this thing on chain, the infrastructure needs to be really, it needs to do three things. It needs to be super, super performant. It needs to be obviously gas efficient, so not that expensive from a gas perspective. And then, of course, from a capital efficiency perspective, which is a very deep part of why we built the risk engine from scratch, So basically, it was like an infrastructure. The answer lied in like, okay, which blockchain can really handle the needs of this very high performance sort of piece of software that we're trying to build. So we knew that we needed something super performant. So that's number one. Now, when it comes to building software, we are big believers in modular versus monolithic. We think that's just a better way to build software. Blockchains in general have this blockchain trilemma problem. Effectively, it's got three attributes. Basically, it has data, it has execution, and you get consensus out of that, or the correct ordering of transactions. In the monolithic world, and this is the case for why we didn't go with someone like Solana, even though that ecosystem is pretty large, and especially recently, it's doing really well. In monolithic world, we believe at some point you have to compromise on one of these attributes. So if you're hyper-optimizing for execution, then it means it's coming at the expense of security or decentralization in some way. In our world, we knew that this execution and performance was such a big criteria, and we knew that hyper-optimization was an inevitability. Because the business logic is so complex, we needed something that has high throughput and can actually do these calculations on-chain dynamically and with high TPS. If you combine the need with this philosophical bend that we have, that we think that you can only optimize for two out of three at any time, then it was very clear for us that, okay, we're probably going to choose something like ETH versus Solana. That's the first part of the multi-step answer between why ETH versus Solana, or why modular versus monolithic. Another big part of it was the security of ETH was unrivaled. This thing's been around for a long time, so in that sense, it was quite easy if you couple that with our philosophical choice that we think building software in a modular way is better. The question as to which roll-up to go with, because when you say ETH, it's sort of a roll-up centric roadmap. We made this decision, I think at this point, almost 2 years ago. And so we were very early and there was not much data and there were not many solutions around back then. But again, so we almost had to lean on first principles. And at that time, the research that we were reading, it seemed to us that validity proofs are a better long-term solution than optimistic proofs. For that reason, we decided, okay, we want to go with a ZK rollup versus an optimistic rollup. Second step of the answer, which is, okay, ZK rollup in ZK rollup land, what are the options? At that time, again, there were two options. There was Starkware, and Starknet wasn't even live at that point. It was just StarkX, which is what DYDX is built on, and then there was ZK Sync. And I think even at that time, they were just in testnet, or I don't even think the testnet was out. The thing there that was really a selling point for us was DYDX was in production. We saw validity proofs or stock proofs at scale, and basically for the exact application that we wanted to build. We were like, okay, the data is here that these things work at scale. And so then we decided to go with Starkware. And then the last thing, which was equally important to us, when we were speaking to Starkware, it was really important to us to have direct access to the leadership team. From the beginning, we were speaking directly with Uri and Eli and the leadership team. Eli, as you know, is the co-inventor of Starks. And so it's kind of amazing to be working with someone that invented this groundbreaking technology. So we were like, okay, access to the inventor of the technology and the rest of the things that I talked about, which was we saw DYDX in production at scale. We're believers in validity proofs or optimistic proofs. And of course, in general, we believe in the modular way versus monolithic. So those all those two things together led us to building on Starkware or Starknet.
Did you guys factor in, or is it something that you think about, the size of the ecosystem that you're building in? Starkware, obviously, has been around for some time and it's really awesome, but I think it's fair to say that it's smaller compared to other both monolithic chains like Solana, some of the other rollups, maybe Arbitrum, Optimism, that sort of thing. Especially with regards to user adoption, is that something that potentially impacts the growth of the product that's being built?
To us, if you're building an app in this space, I think there's only two things large that you worry about. One is tech, and the second is distribution. Most apps today go to roll-up ecosystems or L1 ecosystems that already have a large distribution because then bootstrapping becomes easier. Bootstrapping is always hard, but if you already have an existing network of users or base of users, then it makes things a lot easier. The answer to your question is, yes, absolutely. We did factor in this thing, but we were so early at that time, even the word app chain didn't exist. Because when we were first talking to Starkware, none of this was a close reality. It was very far away. And so we primarily made the decision based on the tech. We weren't even factoring the distribution because at that time, Arbitrum wasn't around. There was a lot of hype around Solana, but we had ruled that out because we said we didn't want to go with the monolithic chain. For us, it was like, okay, the tech was super important. And that's why we made the decision based on tech. And then the second part of that is it's not that we didn't think about it. We, of course, thought about it, but it also sort of reflects our conviction or how deep a conviction that we have in our ability to bootstrap distribution ourselves. This is our third rodeo building a marketplace. We did it for options. We've done it for future spreads. We kind of know this game. And so we decided that, like, okay, we kind of already have the network and we can figure these bootstrapping problems out because this is the third time we're doing it. And in some sense, we're believers that we are the killer app of a certain ecosystem. And besides, we kind of like hard problems. This by far is the hardest problem that at least we've solved in our professional careers here as in Paradigm. And so you put all those three things together. Yes, we definitely thought about it, but we were just very confident in our ability to bootstrap this thing.
I'm really glad you brought up this distinction between tech and distribution, because frankly, I think all teams are thinking about it. This is a huge thing founders need to worry about. And frankly, I think most of the founders, they're like, well, if the tech's good enough, so be it. I'm just going to go where the users are. And then there's the other situation, which I think you guys did, right, is we're going to build on the best tech and bring the users with us. And I think, frankly, it's too early to tell which strategy will win. I mean, if you look at traditional markets and how operating systems competed against one another for applications, both strategies do work. There's definitely approaches where there's a killer app that crowns an operating system and that operating system becomes a tour de force. But there's also examples of that not working out. So I'm personally really curious to see how this works out.
There's no one path to success. I think some take one, some take the other, some take a blend of both. It's kind of like to each his own. We never try to copy what other people have done. It has to feel right to us. And I think we always lead from the place where, like, okay, let's play to your strengths. We always try to do what we're best at, and then we try to partner with someone that they're best at, effectively. When you frame it that way, Starkware, at least at that time, it was by far the best technical partner. And I do want to sort of take a moment to give a shout out to them, because these are some very hard problems that we're solving, and it's very extremely challenging, but extremely fulfilling. And by far, this is the most impressive and technically competent team that I've ever worked with. Those two things together really are the reason why we decided to sort of work with them.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit now. We've chatted about perpetuals as products. We've chatted about Paradigm. We've chatted about how the technical decision for Paradox came out. Now, maybe you can kind of turn to the current perps market. It's not going to be a surprise to you. This is an incredibly competitive market where everyone's playing with points, everyone's playing with tokens and marketing and chasing the same exact customers at a really high level. Like, how do you compete in a really competitive market? And I know we privately chat about this a lot. And of course, at Reverie, we discuss this all the time, but you're in the founder's seat. You're playing this game where you're sort of at the mercy of your stupidest competitor. So if a competitor does something really silly, they're going to steal market share in the short term. How do you actually play this game while it's actually being played actively on the field?
It's not easy, that's for sure. Silly would be okay. The crazy thing in our world is there's a lot less silly and there's a lot of shady, which is wash trading and all kinds of things. It's pretty common knowledge at this point that a lot of the DEXs out there do a lot of shady things to sort of show volume. When everybody's cheating and you're not, then you're kind of the fool. It is definitely not easy to compete, especially if you feel like everybody else is taking shortcuts and doing things out there, but goes back to our DNA as a team. Ultimately, we're here for the long term. We want to build a generational business. So everything we do, we think not in like 2 years or 3 years or 5 years. This name, Paradigm, Paradox, I want this to be around for like 100 years or more. Everything we do, we look towards sort of the future on that long-term timeline. That really helps us refocus. So when we see somebody doing silly or shady things, we're like, look, at the end of the day, the market over a long period of time is ultimately rational. And if you stay the course, then over time, you will win. Now, FTX was a great example. They were taking shortcuts and doing shady things. And to the rest of the world, it just seemed like this company is just going stratospheric in a matter of months. And sometimes it was just it's like I would look at the news and be like, how are they achieving these things? But it all came crashing down. So we take a lot of learning from that experience. We try to apply it here. When it comes to the actual act of competing, everybody's got points. And I know, Larry, you and I have talked about points. points are a great way to bootstrap liquidity, but not when everybody's got points. Then it becomes really difficult to compete because then you have points, somebody else has points. It's like, what's the difference? I do believe points are the new meta, though. Just because everybody's doing it, I don't think they're completely useless. And I do see a lot of points fatigue in the market right now. But I also think because everybody has done points, it sort of led to fatigue. But I think that's also driving teams to do more creative and innovative things and build more creative ways to leverage points in some sort of unique way. So for example, I don't want to give away too much because my team will kill me. But for example, next month, we are launching Paradex Pro League, which is a really, really cool way to combine what I do in my spare time, which is playing Counter-Strike in these sort of like semi-professional leagues or on Faceit with the high-level players, and then combine that with my love for trading, which is my day job. Think esports, but on steroids, where you have sort of like season-by-season hyper-gamified experience, PvP-style trading around earning points, and you have some really, really cool experiences like where you activate Goblin Mode, which is like a power-up. You get dropped like a mystery potion and you can mint a Gamma Goblin NFT from that that gives you fee discounts. Although everybody's got points, I still think there's lots of really, really cool ways that you could leverage points. That itself can be a differentiator.
I totally agree with that. Not all points, just like not all tokens are created equal. And it's easy for investors to say, oh, how are you going to compete with this guy and that guy? But to be viscerally playing that game against competitors who you know are doing some pretty unscrupulous things at times and growing market share, and then the market rewards them, it's hard. Imagine being Coinbase in 2021 when FTX was winning. It was hard for them. And so there's like this emotional factor in it. But to your point, playing those long-term games, first and foremost, reputation is everything in this business, in any business, really. And then two is, how do you manage the team culture to not always go risk on? The moment you create a culture of, we're going to risk it for the biscuit, and we're going to take the most amount of risk and do the most degeny things possible, that's the culture you've inculcated in the team. And often that very same culture leads to the downfall, even though early on it led to the success.
That's exactly right. Look, I think personally, points are a great way to bootstrap liquidity. But points aren't the reason that users will come and stay at the project or protocol level. There are some exceptions where some of these founders are really good at building hype around something. So people will be like, okay, I'm going to come because I think your points are valuable because you've built a lot of hype. But that's more of an exception than the rule. I think points are a great way to get people hooked or at least get them to come to you or come check out your platform. But there has to be a convergence at some point. Points are a great way, I guess, to keep users engaged, or at least that's how I think about it, until you actually execute well on your product roadmap. And it's not just about executing and executing well. It's about creating products that add value. That's the convergence that I'm talking about. Your points are only worth something if you're adding value. And you're adding value if you have long-term PMF. Without that, your points are worthless. And users will leave as soon as they realize that the product is crap or the TTE happens and the airdrop happens and they sort of leave. And we see that a lot in the space. But at the end of the day, like I said, it goes back to what I said in the beginning, which is we're here to build something that is a generational project. And this is a very intrinsic part of this space. And I think if you have that long-term view, then the short-term distractions, they come and they go, but it doesn't really affect us that much. At the end of the day, it's about PMF. And if you're not really hyper-focused on that, points are worthless.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, points are basically something that everybody's doing right now. And since everybody's doing it, they actually have a little bit less value as a distribution mechanism. And what really matters is when you remove those points, what's left? And is there a real product that's left there? And are users going to be happy with that product?
It's not like a binary outcome. Okay, you came to us for the points, and then 6 months later, we didn't deliver on what we said we were going to deliver. When we ship continuously, sometimes thrice a week, you're sort of building a relationship with the user from the time that they come to your platform with the allure of points and with the allure of what they read about your roadmap or what they heard about your reputation, etc. But then every week you've shipped something, and through that, you've built some equity in the mind of the user. That part is super, super important. Companies or projects that do that well will ultimately end up, because at the end of 6 months, okay, maybe you've delayed something, but in those 6 months, every week you ship something, and the customer and the user has seen that this platform when I joined, or this project when I joined was here, but look what they've done. And this adds value to me every day in whatever it is that I do, whether I'm yield farming or staking or trading or whatever. Points are a nice way to sort of like hook you. You have to do the hard work of building that relationship with the customer. And the only way you can do that is if you're continuously shipping something that is making somebody's life easier in some sense. And through that, you build sort of value, and then that value leads to sort of brand equity in the mind of the user.
And how do you think about points per user category? Because perp markets, as you kind of described earlier, they have these different user personas. You have your prosumer traders, you have your slightly more retail traders who might come in and do some stuff every now and then. And then you obviously have your institutional players who are the guys that are really providing the liquidity, the tight spreads, that are maintaining healthy order books. And that's actually your core customer base, or potentially, right, just in terms of like providing a good product. You can build great tech, but you still need liquidity on your platform for it to be good for the rest of the users. Do points target all three? Do they target a specific category? And then how do you address that kind of need for institutional client satisfaction in a perp market?
The answer is a really well-designed points mechanism. That's easily said, but it's very difficult to sort of create something that is fair to both your larger trade and more sophisticated users, but then also the average retail user. A really good example is how we've designed our point system for trading. We have maker points, we have fee points, and then we have OI points. If you do too much of one, then you're screwing someone else on the other side. So there's lots of really cool ways that we've solved that problem. But the high level sort of answer is that you have to be really thoughtful about who your users are, what exactly their motivations are, how much capital they're putting in, how much time they're putting in, and what is the relationship between that effort and capital deployed versus what they're getting back in return. And then, of course, you look at that across all the different types of users, and then you're never going to make everybody happy. You also have to come to this realization, or at least very quickly you will realize that you're never going to make everybody happy. So you have to sort of pick your spots or pick your segments of people. And you say, okay, you know what? In the early days, I'm going to go after X, Y, and Z persona. And then I'll worry about ABC later. Or once I've gotten to the place where X, Y, and Z type of persona is very happy with the platform, then I use them to sort of go to the next concentric circle, which is, let's say, A or B or C. So the sequencing of this problem is as important as, I mean, it's tied to the mechanism, but I like to think of it in A, the mechanism itself, but B, also the sequencing around how you go after which persona of user.
A dumb question, but it's something I've been curious about in perps in particular. Some strategy you've seen spot DEXs use is you basically create a really nice product experience for retail to get retail flow and then match that with institutional liquidity. Are perps markets similar, where you sort of want to match these two counterparties together to create a really compelling product?
This is the central problem to all marketplaces. How do you bootstrap liquidity? The answer to what creates really deep, very liquid, successful marketplaces is actually asymmetry of information, or in the sense that you have one set of users that is less informed than the other set of users. And if you bring these people together, then there will always be trading. If everybody had all the same perfect information all the time, then nobody would be trading, because you need somebody to buy and you need somebody to sell. So this is really an art. This is our third go around sort of doing this. And every market is sort of different. Options is very different. Future spreads is very different. And spread trading is very different. And then doing it on outright perps is very different. The general theme you hear out there is, oh yeah, there's retail and then there's institutions, and you bring people together and boom, you sort of have a market. First of all, it never happens like that. But if it tells you that they can do that, it's lying to you, because if everybody could just do that, then basically we'd have a zillion marketplaces and they'd all be successful. And that's simply not true. So there is a real art to sort of how you match people, or like the types of personas you try to bring together for that first spark that creates the flame. And then once you have the flame, then you bring more and more people and you can fan it more and more. It's a real art how you solve this bootstrapping problem.
Another interesting growth strategy that we see across perp markets is listing new markets, whether that be long tails, new meme coins that are popping up, or really any sort of token that people can trade against. We've seen some exchanges even support pre-launch tokens, where perp markets are set up without even an underlying index price, but it still allows people to start to bet on what could be the future launch price. But with that, though, we actually still see I don't know, the number changes, but it's, let's say, like 80 to 90% even sometimes of the volume is fixed on Bitcoin and Ethereum, maybe Solana and a few other tokens now. How do you guys approach this dilemma of, do we want to list more markets to attract new users that maybe want to take bets on those versus focusing on core product for these assets that actually drive the core volume of an exchange?
The way I think about it is DeGens come for the shitcoins and then they stay for the blue chips. If the liquidity is right, of course. But it's very much the case where the marginal product determines where the user goes. It's like, okay, if I get my favorite bowl of ramen at XYZ supermarket, I'm going to go there. And then maybe I buy all the other things that I need because they're kind of standard and I can get them anywhere. It's very much the thing that I want, which is the marginal choice of the user, or in this case, the marginal product that guides where the user goes. So if you believe that, and some people don't believe that, but we definitely believe that, it's the central thesis to attracting and retaining users. So by extension, that means that, like, okay, you will expect that, like, okay, today we have 10 pairs and in maybe a year's time, I think we will launch close to 1,000 markets, including options. And that's very much the case where the long tail marginal asset or instrument that drives user behavior. And I think that's a great way to attract users. Because if you think about it in DeFi, the DeFi degens, they're basically chasing two things. They're either chasing price action or yield. When I say price action, it's new coin good. You've probably heard that on Twitter a lot. I think it's like, okay, what is the newest, hottest coin? I want to sort of get in that coin before everybody else gets in it and the trade gets crowded. Because on average, these things pump, especially if they're good coins, or sometimes even not, but on average, there's this pump effect. And so everybody wants to try to get into the new hot thing. We believe this, that you're either chasing price action or you're chasing yield. Ideally, you'd want to offer both on the same platform. We don't have a yield product today. At some point, we will launch Vaults, which will be sort of like our version of a yield product. But if you don't have yields, then you must have a vast selection of markets that degens can punt on. It's super important to have these things. And pre-launch is another great example of something that DeFi did that was an advantage over CeFi. Ultimately, if you want people to come to DeFi, you have to offer them something. And if you're saying, hey, this is a better alternative to CeFi, then you got to do something or offer something that you don't get in CeFi. And I think pre-launch markets are a great example of that. And it was a really nice innovation. And I think it's the reason why it's doing well, because it allows DEXs to bring users or attract users before they actually go to the CeFi users when the token actually lists.
So just tying it back to what we were talking about earlier with regards to volatility, it also seems like maybe listing some of these newer markets and even pre-launch tokens is actually a way for these exchanges to introduce volatility into the product, where maybe the blue chips, to your point, have stagnated a little bit. And so again, it's kind of like improves the health of the product maybe. Is that fair?
It's all about engagement at the end of the day. If a DGEN is on the platform and a trader is on the platform, and let's say he's trading XYZ token, and then for whatever reason, that XYZ token is not moving that day, or the narrative is sort of passed, and then, okay, he or she's going to look at trading something else. So if you're able to sort of offer a vast variety of products or options that people can choose from, then you retain the user and the user's engagement. And if you do that, then of course, as you increase the LTV of the user. I think it's very much about capturing engagement and offering a vast selection of products that people want to trade. Of course, you have to worry about liquidity and all of that. But in general, people like more product selection than not.
Anand, this was an awesome expose into pretty much everything on Perps, on Paradex, on Paradigm. We should probably call it here because otherwise we'll go on for hours and hours and hours. But if people want to find you, where do they go?
I am FittyBips1 on Twitter. That's where you can reach out to me.
FittyBips. That's a very trader sort of name. I love it.
Thank you.